Now, what I have a chapter on is Presbyterian nationalisms, plural, and the ways in which Presbyterians in those five different countries are arguing for the presence of Presbyterians in achieving a holy or godly society. I would say the bulk of the Presbyterian tradition that I cover in the book is committed to a Christian nation of some kind. Plenty of Presbyterian churchmen took political views, political sides in the 18th and 19th
Presbyterianism.
centuries. It's still a tension for us today, and I think it explains some of the dynamic between, say, critics of Christian nationalism like myself and the proponents of it. The proponents want a godly society, and I think they can still have their cake and eat it too, a liberal godly society. And I think you can't have both. You can have a liberal society or you can have a godly society. And I prefer a liberal society. So I can watch The Wire. No, I do think, I mean, I do
No,
think, I don't, I think
just
godly and virtuous are different. I think
Okay,
you
so
can
how
have
do you define
virtuous
godly?
people.
Like distinctly Christian?
Right.
That's godly? Okay. Oh boy. I'm excited for this discussion with my friend and yours, Dr. Daryl Hart, D.G. Hart. Daryl, thanks for coming on.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Yes. And this is going to be a more serious conversation. I know you and I, we have a collegial, fun relationship, but you've written a book that I think is going to further a conversation that's going on. It's also going to make some waves, and we want to talk about it. Again, if people follow us online, they know you and I go back and forth. Really, it's you coming at me. But I give it back. And I think I've coined a new name for you, which I use in because of my affinity for you is I call you Doc. No, I call you Unc. Well, I call you Doc and I call you Unc. I call you both. But the Unc is because I've come to view you as an uncle, Daryl. What do you think about that?
That's all right. I mean, there are, I mean, the old drunk uncle at the family, what do you call those? The, family gatherings. I could
No.
play that role, I guess.
No, that's not why I mean it. I don't know if I don't know if it's a
Family
Brooklyn
reunion,
thing.
that's.
Yeah, the family, the crazy uncle. No. Look, I don't know if it's a Brooklyn thing or it's a Syrian thing, but I grew up with all kinds of men that were in our friends of my parents or uncles, friends of uncles, and they were just uncles. They were my uncle. So everybody that we loved and respected was an uncle.
Yeah,
And
that's
not,
fine.
yeah, good. Okay. Well, this book you've written, remind me the title. It's Presbyterians and or Patriots or something.
Well, it's Protestants and Patriots, and then colon, Presbyterians in the Age of Revolution. So it's
You
mainly
know,
about Presbyterians, but the title was trying to point to something bigger. But it is about Presbyterians in. And British politics from 1560s down to the 1870s or so, and it covers both sides of the Atlantic, meaning England, Scotland, Ireland, the United States, and eventually Canada. Just to try to see how Presbyterians worked out their convictions politically in those different. Environments.
yes, and I got the cover on the screen now. It's
You do,
Protestants
that
and
looks.
Patriots. Yeah, Presbyterians in the Age of Revolution. Man, what great timing for this book. And
I
but
laugh only because I've been working on this for a long time, and then all of a sudden, when Notre Dame accepted it and then set the date, I said, oh man, this is great. it coincides with the 250th. Not as if this is only about the American Revolution and Presbyterians in it, even though that is the hook I use at, in the introduction, is to think about the American Revolution, whether it was a Presbyterian rebellion, which is one of the phrases that even King George III said. But, I mean, the Presbyterian politics were much more tumultuous 100 years or more before the 1770s.
Yes, and you start to you outline it. But I was thinking, I wasn't even thinking the 250th. But you're right. That, but just also okay. Just like the
you're the current, better churchman, George. Yeah,
I'm not the better churchman. I'm just thinking, you know, the debates that often bring us together, but just all that's going on with Christian nationalism and retrieval efforts on Presbyterian history. And so, but yeah, it says right in the preface, it says you started this book in 2012, or at least the ideas have been consolidating in your mind for that long. And you highlight, I forgot about this. I think in our first interview, we talked about this briefly, but you were actually at LaBrie with Francis Schaeffer. And
I was.
Of course. Yeah, of course, you're the Machen historian, and so you actually use that in the beginning of this book to talk about, it seemed to me, maybe two streams of thought within Presbyterianism regarding public and political theology. Am I getting that right?
Right. Although I have exchanged emails recently with someone else who said, but you might want to add a third to that preface, and it has to do with pre-1700. But anyway, that gets into the weeds of the book. But yes, I mean, in reflecting on my life as I get older and think about I didn't grow up Presbyterian, grew up Baptist, but my exposure to Presbyterianism, beginning with Schaeffer and then Machen, I was trying to fit this endeavor into that longer history. You know, and this is partly, the older I get, the more nostalgic I get, so I'm trying to think about my own life in some ways and try to pull these strands together. But it was what's also funny about the Schaeffer reference is I was at LaBrie 50 years ago. 50 years ago! Sheesh.
Wow. Yeah. So how does that play out? Like, how do you use that? Like, do those form streams of thought that you look, you know, back into history and then forward to? I guess you don't look forward.
Well,
so
it's
much because
it's mainly the kind of spirituality of the church position that Machen represents, and the church staying out of politics, and Schaeffer being more activist, and those are two. That's a yin and yang that's obviously playing out now. Under the umbrella in some ways of Christian nationalism. But the book only gets up to 1875 in the case of Canada. And so I really don't get to the 20th century. And Machen, I doubt, is even in the book other than in the preface. Okay. So that was mainly just a kind of a fresh start for the preface sake, to bring those relatively contemporary voices into the mix.
So is that going to be volume two to go from?
I don't think so, but you never know. Yeah.
So in the cover on the page with the testimonials, it says, Hart compellingly explains first why Presbyterianism was politically disruptive in Britain for 150 years, and then how those Protestants adjusted to liberal democracy. It goes on, it says, Presbyterians remained politically assertive, but switched from state churches and covenanted monarchs to civil and religious liberties and republican government. And it goes on, it says, Presbyterianism unintentionally laid the groundwork for religious disestablishment and religious freedom. In doing so, Presbyterians became unlikely defenders of liberal democracy. That's not going to be controversial, is it, Doc? You know, because you, if I'm understanding this right, again, there's these, you know, we use the phrase retrieval. So retrieval efforts to go back into the tradition to see what Presbyterians, Southern Presbyterians in the 19th century and before, but then before that, how they viewed public and political theology. There's obviously a covenanter framework. I think you talk about that. There's established churches. There's all these conversations, but you're essentially saying, well, it says this here, Presbyterianism unintentionally laid the groundwork for religious disestablishment and religious freedom. So what do you mean by that, and how do you develop that?
Yeah, well, unintentionally, because originally Presbyterians in England, but more so in Scotland, wanted to reform the national church. And that really is where they become, Presbyterians become disruptive. Again, more in Scotland in ways than in England. But by wanting to remove bishops and substitute Presbyterian government, and also by, and this is really where it gets kind of, you can see maybe 1776, way, way, way implied in this. But when England in the English Reformation makes Henry VIII the head of the church, because you have to have a head of the church that's, if not the Pope, who's it going to be? Well, it's going to be the king. But I mean, that's a stick that's jabbing Presbyterians through the cage. Well, you know, Jesus can only be the head of the church. It can't be the king. So on those two flanks, Presbyterians, simply by holding to their own ecclesiology, become a real pain in the neck to the English crown and the Scottish crown. And then once those crowns unite in James the First, previously, well, still James the Sixth of Scotland in 1603, and the whole Stuart monarchy throughout the 17th century, Presbyterians are always butting heads with the Stuarts. But what eventually happens is Presbyterians learn the lesson of the problems of established churches, and one by one they begin to peel away from it. I mean, some of the first examples of that would be the Irish, who see that the established church in Ireland is Anglican, and they also see that the majority population in Ireland, which is Roman Catholic, they see that that's not working out well. So it's the Irish. It takes them a while to get there, but they begin to see the problems of establishment. Of course, the Americans do at the time of the founding. Canadians eventually do. But also the Free Church of Scotland, even though on paper in 1843, they're still committed to the establishment principle. They also are functionally a disestablishment church, because it's just really hard to get the state to do what you want it to do when it comes to the true faith. But that was the original goal, was the true faith. And Presbyterians in Scotland, I mean, set up this scaffolding that would constantly be appealing to anyone who's working in a kind of Scottish Reformation tradition. They establish a covenant with James the Sixth of Scotland in 1581, I think it is, the King's Confession, where everyone subscribes to this covenant, that the king, parliament, the people, and the church will all be committed to the true religion and also opposed to Roman Catholicism. So it's a both and, or either or. And then they invoke that covenant again in 1638 with the National Covenant of the Scots. And then in 1643, when the Scots make an alliance with parliament, English parliament, and form the Solemn League and Covenant, that language is still there. Again, this covenantal language that's going to commit all of the people and the king and parliament and the church to the true religion. And that kind of goes haywire. This is really where it gets revolutionary, in the wars, civil wars of the 1640s, first between English Parliament and Charles I's army, and then eventually Scots come on board with that. And eventually that civil war results in something that even the Scots thought was unimaginable, unthinkable, which is the execution of Charles I for treason. And that's regicide, and these Presbyterians are reading their Old Testaments, and they know that David, the great king of the Old Testament, I heard a sermon recently where Josiah is the goat, the greatest of all time Hebrew monarchs, but David's pretty big deal, and he refuses in that civil war between him, as it were, between him and Saul. He refuses. He had a chance to kill Saul, or his soldiers did, and he says, "Nope, you don't kill the Lord's anointed," and that's what Cromwell and the Rump Parliament did. They killed the Lord's anointed. I mean, and Charles I had actually taken the covenant. Sure, his fingers were crossed, but anyway, so that's the tumultuous side of Presbyterian politics in the, especially the first half of the 17th century, that makes the American Revolution look like child's play a little bit. I mean, I really do think there's, in some ways, it doesn't, the American Revolution doesn't come close to comparing to the 1640s in England and Scotland, and even Ireland, where some of those wars also took place.
Wow, I wouldn't have guessed that. So that's something I'll look forward to. Because obviously, I didn't have time to read the whole
Sure.
book. What would you define? How would you define the thesis, or how would you explain what you're setting out to do here?
Well, I think that the thesis is a question. It is, was the American Revolution a Presbyterian rebellion? And related to that, are Presbyterians inherently rebellious? Because there is, this Dutch Reformation was a war against the Spanish monarchy. I mean, there are a lot of wars at the time of the Reformation, the 16th into the 17th centuries, among the Reformed, Lutherans as well, but the Reformed sometimes people attribute to Reformed and Presbyterians this idea of resistance theory and when it's legitimate to actually rebel against a tyrant. And there's a long literature about that resistance to tyranny. And I mean, you can find that literature even before the Reformation, when there are emperors or kings that the Roman Catholic Church is worried about in the Middle Ages. You'll also see people talking about whether it's possible or legitimate to rebel against a tyrant. And there are some Roman Catholic theologians who make that case. It wouldn't be the dominant position, but it would be there. So it's not as if Calvinists alone own this position, even though it's often attributed more, I think, to Calvinists because of the American Revolution. So I'm trying to unpack that and see whether that's the proper way to understand Presbyterian politics, if it's inherently rebellious. And my argument is no, that's not, I mean, that may be, but my argument is no, church polity, Presbyterianism itself, what Calvin did with his ecclesiastical ordinances in 1541, and Presbyterian, sorry, Scottish and English exiles exiled from England during the reign of Mary Tudor, between 1553 and 1558, they went to Geneva, and they were gobsmacked. They couldn't believe that there was any place on earth as Christian as Geneva, other than at the time of the apostles. And so they wanted to bring back Calvin's reforms to England and Scotland, and from there, the fireworks sort of begin. 1560s, 70s, 80s, not as much, but in the 17th century, it does become much more combative. And it's so Presbyterian polity, Presbyterian church government, which I should probably say that Presbyterian church government really is a novelty. Yes and no. I mean, that's, but for, 1,300, 1,200 years, the dominant way of governing the church in the West was with bishops. Duh. And Calvin comes along and thinks, we're going to run the church not with bishops, but with councils? Really? Where did you ever get that idea? Well, there is a conciliar tradition in the 15th century, probably even beyond, as a way of reforming the church and trying to hedge in the papacy. But still, everyone thought episcopacy was the way to run the church. And that actually leads, and this is something I'd like to do maybe in a second volume, but it would be more a collection of writings, is the debates between Anglican bishops and Presbyterians over the early church and its government are fascinating. Trying to figure out, well, what was the nature of church government in the early church? And both sides, I think, give as well as they get. It's a pretty fascinating debate. It's also largely all beyond scripture, because scripture, you know, I think with Acts 15 and the Council of Jerusalem, you could argue, and also the pastoral epistles, you could argue that the bones of a Presbyterian government are there, a conciliar kind of government, government by council assembly. And then bishops emerge, and they really take off once Constantine converts. And then the empire and the emperor find bishops a much better way to oversee a Christian empire.
So was Presbyterianism viewed as politically subversive in that time after Calvin's Geneva, as it comes and starts to become exported to places, again, that had bishops and state churches? And
well, in effect, yes, because in England, at least, and this is kind of, I think Presbyterians and Presbyterianism took off in Scotland much more than in England, because the Scottish Reformation really did begin to implement a general assembly in ways that there was never a general assembly in England. But the debates in England between someone like Thomas Cartwright and Whitgift, I can't remember his first name right now, one of the bishops, one of the archbishops of Canterbury. One of the defenses of the Church of England at that time is to point out that Presbyterians really are challenging the king, or in this case, Queen Elizabeth, as the head of the church. And so from their perspective, if you're challenging the royal supremacy of the church, you're doing something inherently political. And that's, again, where I think political theorists and historians of political science, in looking at resistance theory, have not really looked at Presbyterian church government and this ornery Presbyterian conviction that no, only Christ can be head of the church. That is really pretty politically potent. And it remains so from 1560 all the way down to the end of the 17th century. When it finally, with the Glorious Revolution, there's finally, okay, we're over it. We figured out how to put this together and make it work. By that point, though, the Covenanters, you know, who are still in our midst, and sometimes some of today's Christian nationalists appeal to the Covenanters, or sometimes they don't, but the Covenanters are not happy with that political settlement at the end of the 17th century. They're still insisting by their name on the covenants, and they want the established church. They want a covenanted king who's going to cooperate with the church. So that ideal has not gone away for the Covenanters. Even, I think, today in America, both the Covenanters and the Associate Reformed begin in the 18th century, but they pick up on some of that covenantal language as well when they leave the Church of Scotland in 1732 or so.
Right. So I never put that together, that and it's so obvious, honestly, that Presbyterian polity is itself politically subversive.
Oh, don't say it's obvious, George. People need to read the book.
Well, that we will, you know, but
because that's the only way you see it. That's the only way you see it. It's not. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
No. Well, but I mean, obviously, it makes sense to that. But how it plays out is what I'm hoping the book is going to show, because I'm curious.
Oh, yeah.
And my history is really, really poor, honestly.
That's fine.
But did those Presbyterian, they were looking to reform the political order through this, weren't they? Again, after Geneva. Because they knew they couldn't exist with the polity they wanted in a place that had established churches that weren't Presbyterian. Is that correct? So they were trying to bring it to a political head.
Except that, and this is the kicker for Americans, is that the English and the Scots were perfectly happy to have a monarchy. I mean, the American contribution really is to challenge monarchy as the ideal political order. But most of the British Protestants on both sides of the Atlantic, Canadians, Irish, Scots, and English, are perfectly happy with a monarchy as long as Jesus is the head of the church and the monarch is serving King Jesus. They really aren't interested in a republican form of government, even though you could argue that structurally a conciliar form of church government is much more compatible with a republican kind of political order, because of the nature of assemblies and representation and all that. It's not democracy, but it is a kind of aristocratic element where you have elders, aristocrats, noble people meeting in assembly to govern a realm or a city, which is what Calvin's Geneva was as well. That was a city council governing the city. And so in that sense, Presbyterian church government is more compatible in some ways with a republican style government, which is why toward the end of the book, I think I have a chapter on republicanism, or maybe on a kind of, what I have a chapter on is Presbyterian nationalisms, plural, and the ways in which Presbyterians in those five different countries are arguing for the presence of Presbyterians in achieving a holy or godly society, even though you don't have an established church. And two of the voices I use from the American chapter, one of these guys is Thomas Smythe, I believe, who was an Irishman who went to South Carolina, and he writes a book about republicanism is basically the Presbyterian form of civil government. And it's actually a smart book. It's a little bit overdone, but he does make this point of connecting a republican form of government with Presbyterian form of church government.
Well, right. I mean, you know, and as a Presbyterian pastor often would say that, you know, that our American government is modeled after our church polity. Is that saying too much? It's a happy coincidence that there's a lot of similarities between representative government and the different branches and committees and et cetera. Like the right. correlation that you're mentioning is our form of government modeled after Presbyterian polity?
I think it's more correlation or coincidence than it is causation. But I do think that what is in the backdrop of both the American Revolution and also of Presbyterian government is this idea that you need to have checks on the sovereign. Whether it's the king, you have to have checks on him, or if it's the pope, or which, you know, isn't an issue anymore for Protestants, but there is still this element that you have to check power. You don't want consolidated power, which is what, I mean, what the English monarchy and the Scottish monarchy was when Presbyterianism was starting in the 1560s. You had divine right monarchy, and you had all sorts of Christian theologians defending divine right monarchy and royal supremacy over the church as the God-ordained pattern for governing the world, because God himself governs the world as sovereign, a single sovereign.
So
God himself is a divine right monarch. Even though, you know, if you push on the Trinity part, though, God is a divine right council. Because you have three governing. You don't want to go too far with the one and the three. But still, there is a kind of interesting aspect to the Trinity that makes the persons of the Trinity a kind of assembly. I hope I'm not doing anything heretical about that.
I'll leave that up to others. Do you think that it's a uniquely Presbyterian contribution to challenge divine right monarchy, or at least at the size Presbyterianism was?
I do, actually. Okay. I mean, because nowhere else, and I'm not an expert on all of European history, but I have checked with my European historian colleagues here and elsewhere, and I don't think there's anywhere else that the Reformation happened and made the prince or the king or the emperor the head of the church. And those are just fighting words from the get-go with the English Reformation. They're fighting words for Presbyterians, at least. And that's, I think, also why, in a way, you know, we have this weird element. Weird maybe is too strong. It's maybe not the right word. But this, how do you talk about Napark churches when you have Presbyterian and Reformed? Well, wait, aren't Presbyterians Reformed? Wait, aren't Reformed people, aren't they Presbyterian polity? Why do we have these two words? Well, in the British Isles, Presbyterians made a real case out of being Presbyterian because they were fighting against the head of the church, who was the king. Whereas, and the churches on the continent, the Reformed ones, didn't have that same kind of battle. They didn't have to identify with a church polity the way Presbyterians in the English-speaking world did. I mean, that's my, it's kind of a hunch, but it's also, I think, borne out by the material I cover in the book, that the reason why we go by the name Presbyterian in the PCA, the OPC, etc., is because of the way that the reforms in the English and Scottish churches played out when Presbyterians were trying to further reform the church.
Mm. Do you think there's something inherent in the church being the church that inevitably collides with the state? Like in what you were saying about how Presbyterianism, in my words, was politically subversive as it goes to a place because it challenges the current political order and their church-state relations. I mean, that was ringing in my ears just about Christianity and the Roman Empire and how, you know, Roman government didn't trust Christians because they didn't mm-hmm. recognize, you know, is there something there? That's just a total tangent that's not applicable.
No, I think there is certainly something there, again, which points to the novelty of Calvin's church government. And it wasn't as if Calvin came up with this on his own. I think his years in Strasbourg...
Are you saying that pejoratively or just that it was unique?
No, I'm saying it was unique. It's a singular contribution that Calvin made. And again, I don't think he did that entirely on his own. I think he learned from Martin Bucer when he was in Strasbourg. And I think in certain imperial cities where the Reformation took root, like Strasbourg or Geneva, I don't know if Geneva was an imperial city, but anyway, imperial cities have a weird kind of place within the empire as well. The Holy Roman Empire is really kind of fascinating politically, how it worked and functioned or didn't function. But I don't think Calvin came up with it, you know, entirely on his own. I think he was talking to other reformers as well, but it was then the English and the Scots, especially the Scots, who took Calvin's polity even farther. And then as it played out in the political environment of England and Scotland, with the monarchies that were there in place, it had, again, more potency than it may have had on the continent.
Yeah. Okay. To take you back a little bit, back into the preface, you say Presbyterians have generally fallen into two camps. One, those who think government works best when it is upholding God's truth. And two, those who believe the church is the chief vehicle for Christianity. Do you want me to repeat it?
Go ahead. Please do.
This is in reference to Schaeffer and Machen. So you said the Schaeffer and Machen stances on church-state relationships have nevertheless become the backbone of this book. Presbyterians have generally fallen into two camps. So here's the camps that you
outlined.
Yeah, sure. Those who think government works best when it's upholding God's truth, that's camp one for the Presbyterians, and the other camp is simply those who believe the church is the chief vehicle for Christianity. Yeah. And I'm curious, maybe to be more specific, I'm curious why those two things in your mind are at odds.
It's not that they are at odds. At certain times, they are together. And I think between 1560 and 1650, generally speaking, Presbyterians are pulling in the same direction, both of those Presbyterians, but it's after realizing that you can't trust government. Government's not going to do it. Government's going to waffle on Christianity. They will support a church, but it's going to be a church that isn't going to be reformed. It's going to be a church, and this is the nature of established churches as well, it's going to have to incorporate all of that society because it's the church of that state, of that country. And I think, you know, eventually there are some Presbyterians who recognize maybe first, the Covenanters even in a way recognize this at the time, at the end of the 17th century, that they can't trust Charles II or even William III of the Glorious Revolution. So they're going to opt out into their conventicles. Or, and in the 18th century, you have the Seceder Church, Associate Reformed. They still have an ideal of an established church, but they pull out as well and think, no, you can't trust the government. Of course, the Americans are already experiencing this, Presbyterians in the colonies. They don't have an established church. They understand if the Christianity is going to go forward, it's going to be depend on the church doing it itself. And then eventually the Free Church of Scotland also recognizes, wait, we can't trust the British government to support us. We have to try to do something differently, even though we're still going to talk about an establishment. And I would say even Canadians, well, the Irish also come to that realization in the 1870s, but the Canadians kind of figure out a way to have to cooperate with Anglicans in Canada. And you know, for listeners, American Presbyterians do not pay enough attention to Canadian Presbyterianism, and in some ways for good reason, because Canadians haven't done well. No offense to any Canadian listeners, but I mean, it's been, they've really struggled at times to be a the kind of vigorous Presbyterianism that we like in the United States. On the other hand, when you think about Canadian history before Confederation, before Canada becomes a dominion within the empire, you have colonies, British colonies, north of the United States, where they're having to try to put together two Protestant ministers from two established church traditions. You have Anglicans and thinking, no, we're the state church here, thank you very much, in Canada. And you have Presbyterians. No, we are the state church here in Canada. And both sides are right because the Anglicans are the state church in England and the Presbyterians are the state church in Scotland. Now try to sort that one out, which is part of the driver of 19th century Canadian Protestant history. And as somebody who likes history messy, boy, it's messy. And on top of that, the Presbyterians in Canada, you have all strands. You have Covenanters, you have Seceders, you have Free Church, and you have Church of Scotland. And they're all trying to say, no, we're the real Presbyterians.
Is so as you're talking, and again, again, this isn't my area, but like I'm well in tune and aware of the current debates around Christian nationalism and the different church state relation positions, and like I'm hearing a lot of echoes in that little description there of those debates that we can't trust the government and which Christian nationalism, which quote unquote Christian prince is it going to be? And like, does your work, like, was part of the motivation of your work to flesh that out? Or does this just is your work in this book just confirming your positions on this? Or is this how you came to these positions on this? Like, how do you
Right.
associate this book with your views?
So it really is coincidental or providential. I would say providential that the book is coming out in 2026 at the time of America's 250th and at a time when these debates are going on about Christian nationalism. And I would say that this book has challenged my views in some way that even after the American Revolution, Presbyterians in the 19th century, or even after the Glorious Revolution at the end of the 17th century, Presbyterians in the 18th and 19th centuries still have a view of a godly society that I think is a carryover from the old covenant position that the Scots had. And that leads Presbyterians to be much more reformist in their politics than I personally am myself. Now, if I were living at that time prior to 1870, I might be more reformist because I still think there was more of a Protestant consensus, or at least demographic, in the United States than there is today. So that's one way I can sort of make sense of my differences from, say, Charles Hodge on some of these matters. But I do think that there is a, there nationalists, Christian nationalists, will find parts or much of this book supporting their view that Presbyterians have really been committed to a Christian nation, although it's not a unified or even coherent view because it has to keep adjusting to different political realities. But I would say the bulk of the Presbyterian tradition that I cover in the book is committed to a Christian nation of some kind. And whether that means a Christian government or an established church or a political party that's going to prevent mail from being distributed on the Lord's Day, or that's going to restrict slavery, not abolish it, but restrict it, etc. Plenty of Presbyterian churchmen took political views, political sides in the 18th and 19th centuries.
So, did specific prescriptions for policies aside, that last paragraph you just said about pursuing a Christian nation, like, have you, like, what does that look like to you?
Well, to them, it looked like it depended on the place. In
Yeah, and
America,
time.
it looked like a harmony among the Protestant denominations, generally pulling in the same direction and supporting either the Whig Party or the Republican Party. And political parties, one thing that we take for granted is suffrage and you know, universal vote. But there were all sorts of restrictions on voting, both sides of the Atlantic. You know, so you got to factor that into it as well. But in Scotland and England, most Presbyterians would have supported the Whig Party and not the Tories, because the Tories were on the side of the Anglican establishment. But when it came to reforming corn laws or promoting education and funding for schools or, you know, other kinds of reformist matters like that, all sort of trying to cultivate a middle class that would be self-reliant and godly, those British Protestants were supporting those political views. And personally, that wouldn't be my preference. You know, and this is good. I hope you find this funny, George, because in those societies, you wouldn't have been able to make The Wire. The Wire would not have been on HBO would not exist. Anyway, so.
Touche. You've been a good sport about that.
But I really do enjoy certain kinds of entertainment that I think is oftentimes serious and not merely entertainment, that I also understand is offensive in certain respects to Christians. And it's for that reason we wouldn't have those.
You know, I just put these out there. Like, I didn't do anything for that Wire clip to get clipped. And I wonder if you're going to give them more ammunition. I just, what I like is you're just a good sport about it. I know your time is limited. I'm going to go to the end of the introduction and read some things.
Okay.
The second to last paragraph at the end of it, it says, in sum, Presbyterians and Patriots, which is interesting. And that's why I called it Presbyterians and Patriots, because you have that in italics, but the title of the book's actually Protestants.
Yeah, that's a mistake. I should have caught that. Anyway.
Yeah, that's great.
Oops.
I think it's wise to have the book entitled Protestants and Patriots. That way people don't think it's such a limited focus. But Presbyterians and Patriots highlights the degree to which ecclesiastical reform was a catalyst in major political developments within Britain and North America. The same set of developments also shed light on the way that Western Christians, in this case Presbyterians, adjusted their own desires for church and society to the realities of society after Christendom. Okay. Both these stories, church reform leading to a godly society and liberal politics protecting churches, give Presbyterianism a sort of double-mindedness. Are you able to speak to that statement? So both of these stories, story one, church reform leading to a godly society, and number two, liberal politics protecting churches, give Presbyterianism a sort of double-mindedness.
Right. And this is where I think, anyway, I do think, for instance, Charles Hodge wanted a godly society and wanted government to support certain views that would not have been as liberal as, say, the Democrats would have wanted it to be. And so the question is, how do you resolve, harmonize the desire for godliness in society and also freedom that allows people to be in error, both in error doctrinally, but also perhaps, also in error in worship, but also perhaps in error even in certain kinds of morality, that just because something is immoral doesn't mean we're going to pass laws about it. And that's the tension, I think, in 19th century Presbyterianism. It's still a tension for us today, and I think it explains some of the dynamic between, say, critics of Christian nationalism like myself and the proponents of it. The proponents want a godly society, and I think they can still have their cake and eat it too, a liberal godly society. And I think you can't have both. You can have a liberal society or you can have a godly society. And I prefer a liberal society. so I could watch The Wire. No, I do think. I mean, I do think I would justify a liberal society because of the inter-advental period in which we now live in this stage of redemptive history, where the established church and using government was part of the Old Testament church. And that is no longer the norm for the New Testament church. And Constantine screwed that up. And people loved Constantine or parts of Constantine and loved the Christian empire, Christian state. But I don't know that that's necessarily what Jesus and the apostles had in view, that they were seen to be. They were working certainly in a society that was mixed and Christians weren't even dominant. Does that mean that has to be the norm? Maybe it doesn't have to be the norm, but it certainly is legitimate if Jesus and the apostles are working in that environment. Anyway, that's what I mean by that. You can't have both a liberal society and a Christian society. It doesn't seem to me. But Protestants in the 19th century came close. And they gave up the Covenanters. They gave up that side, that brand of a godly society. They didn't have to have a covenant anymore. So they were liberal in that sense. They had broken with the Covenanters.
Yeah, but like I'm shocked to hear some of this, because I thought your contention has been we can actually have, again, it depends on how you're using the word godly, but a virtuous society, like, without it being distinctly Christian in politics.
Right.
But here you're saying I think
godly and virtuous are different. I think you can have virtuous people.
Like, distinctly Christian,
right?
That's godly. Okay, so we can't have a distinctly Christian society in the way you perceive government should be.
Right. I mean, I think you could have a distinctly Christian society conceivably if you converted 70-80% of the population to we have 70% Christian right now, but evangelicals are about 23% of that. Mainline is another 19% or so. Black church is another whatever. And then the Roman Catholics are another 23% or so. So you combine all those, you get about 70% Christian, you know, and then you have a majority group conceivably, but they don't agree, so they can't be a majority, really.
Well, it's not simply they don't even agree on ethics, let alone on theology. So when did it work best? Including today. I know your book doesn't come up to today, but if you just look at everything from, let's just forget Constantine or whatever, take Calvin's Geneva across Europe through to today here, where did it work best?
I would say the period between the Glorious Revolution, 1688, and the American Revolution, 1776, between those periods, roughly, or even up to the Constitutional Convention. But that's a time when you have restraints on the sovereign, you have restraints on government, you have checks and balances emerging, both with a constitutional monarchy and then eventually a federal system in America, you know, religiously, I think the colonial Presbyterian Church doesn't get the kind of praise, the kind of headlines that maybe it could. It's understudied. I mean, I think the best time for American Presbyterianism is old school Presbyterianism in the 19th century. And I think also the Free Church in Scotland was pretty remarkable as well.
But didn't the colonists through to the 1800s, they conceive of themselves as even if they were disestablished and all that, they conceive of themselves as a Christian country?
Probably they did. I mean, I'm not trying to be...
No, I know. Did you? I know we're in a rush. That's why I keep interrupting.
Yeah.
Did you read Miles? I know you're. You know, you and Miles are good friends.
I did.
Did you read
his religion? It's been a while, but I thought that was largely convincing. But I mean, I think you didn't have to say it. That's what I'm stumbling about. I don't know if people talked about it explicitly, but you didn't have to say it as much because demographically, the United States was largely homogenous. Protestants.
Yeah. Okay. Again, I know we have a hard stop here coming up, so I want to ask you the Patriot piece. As we close, give us a little monologue on patriotism as it reflects in this book. It's in the title, but also your own patriotism as we look to the 250th.
Well, I mean, I have a chapter on the American on America at the Revolution, and I really do admire Witherspoon and Frances Allison, who doesn't get talked about as much, and the ways that they kind of tried to understand the American founding, the American Rebellion, I think is I find quite compatible. But where I've become more patriotic, and I don't want to sound like I'm just here slinging books, but I have another book coming out this year later on the history of Independence Hall. And, you know, it's about the building where Continental Congress met for the Declaration, the Constitution, and eventually becomes a national park in the 1940s. But as I replayed what transpired at Independence Hall in the 1770s and 80s, I just have become really amazed at what a great story the American founding is. And I'm very proud to be a citizen of this country and to have that as the beginnings of the country. I think the founders were flawed men in many respects, obviously, but also really great. And, you know, taking on the superpower in the world, taking on the British Empire in war, is just extraordinary. And of course, the United States needed lots of help from France, and they even got some help from Spain, and maybe even the Dutch a little bit. You know, so it wasn't just the Americans themselves, but it could have gone south in so many ways, and it didn't, and it's really a great story.
When's your last day at Hillsdale?
You mean before retirement or for the semester? Oh, not until next spring.
Oh, okay. Okay, so you won't
be back.
I'm
teaching another year.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Well, good. Yeah. I'm happy for you. You won't be back in Philly then for the 250th, will you?
Well, I'll probably go back this summer. My wife and I have a cottage north of Boston, a summer cottage. Get this, in a Wesleyan campground, Methodist campground.
Of course.
Which is generically mainline, but it's very pleasant there. So, but that's easier to get to Philadelphia from there than it is from Michigan by train or whatever. And I'm sure I'll be back in the city for some of it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. And I just encourage listeners to get the book, Protestants and Patriots. Is it plural? Did I say the title correctly?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Well, thanks, George. This has been great. I appreciate it.
Take care. You're welcome. Goodbye.
All right. Bye.
The training of the next generation of pastoral leaders is of vital importance. The problem is that seminary is oftentimes incredibly expensive. You have to uproot your family. You have to go to another place where you're not plugged into a local church. What BTS does is it provides a way for people to continue in their hometown, continue in their present ministry, gain the tools that they need for pastoral leadership, be equipped for the work of the ministry for the long haul, and do it inexpensively but substantively. I love that about Birmingham Theological Seminary.